That's the music of Nicholas Payton, and this is Dave Douglas with the Greenleaf Music Podcast, A Noise from the Deep. I got a chance to chat with Nick in September 2020 during the online Festival of New Trumpet Music. Nick created a piece for the festival, which we will excerpt in this episode. His piece is a collaboration with the looping and sampling artist Sasha Masakowski. This conversation is drawn from a post-show Zoom chat that Nick and I had. He had a lot of amazing and insightful things to say, and I greatly enjoyed the conversation. I'm creating this introduction less than 1 month before our national election. I'm optimistic we can make positive change. It's important to keep our eyes on all the things we will need to continue changing even after we learn of the national and statewide results. Our many pandemics will not be quickly healed. We all need to stay involved and engaged, and it's going to take huge sociological changes to rebound from these disasters and to avoid others. Onward. Thanks for listening, and thanks for doing all you do. Join me at greenleafmusic.com to hear all the music we make, and join us as a supporting member. Thank you. Here's Nicholas Payton.
Survival is not a one-time decision. It's 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 one-time. 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 Time. 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 Time.
All right. What a beautiful piece. I'm Dave Douglas. We're closing down the Festival of New Trumpet Music 2020 online virtual edition. And Nicholas Payton, thank you so much for joining me to talk about it.
Cool. What's up, Dave?
It's a beautiful piece. And we'd be normally sitting out selling CDs after the gig now under normal times. So it's nice to get to talk about the music and talk about what's happening. So what time is it where you are and where are you?
I'm home in New Orleans. It is 7:18 Central Standard Time.
And how's everything going with storms and all of that?
Well, we've made it thus far. I don't want to get cocky about it, but Sally missed us. I think Laura missed us. So we're good so far. Prayers and blessings to those who haven't been as fortunate.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed that it's your birthday next week, so happy birthday. Is it true? Is September 26th, I think, right?
Yeah.
Great, man.
Yeah.
Felicitaciones. So, Sasha not being here, and I think it's really cool that she's not here because she actually has a gig.
Yeah, it's
great to hear.
I remember those. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the two of you playing together, it's so fluid. It's so, I've watched it a few times now, so I think I might be starting to catch on a little bit to how, but have you been working together a long time?
Consistently, we've been working together pretty much since the lockdown. We played a couple times before that, and the other partner of ours, Cliff Hines, is kind of a trio. But, we did a gig or so before all of this and talked about recording and doing some stuff, but our schedules wouldn't quite align. So blessing in disguise, all of a sudden, mid-March, we had all the time in the world. So I said, let's get together. And really right before the door shut on all of this, Friday the 13th, we set up in my crib for 2 days, the 13th and 14th, March 13, 14, and knocked out the record in my dining room / living room. Set up, Cliff Hines is a brilliant guitarist, though he didn't play guitar on this album. He played modular synth. And was our recording engineer, Sasha, is the loop master and runs the drum machine. And basically she records, as you see on the video tonight, me playing different instruments in real time. And we basically develop these beats in real time. And, you know, we kind of have somewhat of a set parameters and certain things, certain vocal samples from various people who we heard tonight, be it Jerry Allen or Janiqua Charles or Audre Lorde, Erykah Badu, some samples from James Brown. So basically I'm drawing from the pool of great Black artists to create this pastiche, if you will, of a boundaryless sort of expression of the different eras and the contexts of Black American music as filtered through us right now. So it's not merely just a repertory piece of past works, but the whole missive is to bring it into the current time. So circling back to that, we did an album, which is one of the first that I know of, quarantine albums entitled Quarantine with Nick, which is probably the fastest album I've ever recorded, mixed and mastered within a 2-week span total, and got it out to the public by the end of March.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. That's really, I don't want to get nerdy because the equipment thing is like such a small part of it, but I'm just, okay. What is Sasha using? What is she playing with?
The looper, and maybe they should give us an endorsement for saying this.
keep it behind the paywall. If you
know, right? She's using a Boss 505 looper, RC 505, I think it is, and maybe a Vocal Beats drum machine, and then another by Digitech Electron, I think.
I see. So you're passing her.
So I'm feeding her.
You're feeding her loops, whether it's from the keyboard or the bass.
Exactly.
Sometimes the trumpet.
Exactly.
But I noticed like you had a little cueing system. Like you'd be playing the instrument for a while and then you'd be like a little, you know, subtle.
Yeah. We got to start and stop like where the loop ends and begins.
Yeah.
And sometimes I might fuck up and I want another take. So it's like, let's do it again. So, yeah.
But you're doing it all in real time. So like, is the piece like one whole pass?
Well,
there's probably some.
It's kind of like a DJ set. For instance, like we set a BPM.
Yeah.
The looper and the drum machine sort of operates that way. And even when Cliff is with us, when he has the modular, we all kind of have to set a BPM that we're working through. But obviously we don't necessarily want to play it, if I set it at 90, we don't want to have to do the whole set that way. So if you notice, and if you go back to the archive and listen, we might start at 90 or something, whatever the BPM was. But when we did Jerry Allen's piece, Feed the Fire, I wanted a little bit of an edge to it. I felt like we needed to change the tempo. So I said, hike it up a little bit. And she started just increasing the BPM. And then when it got to where I thought it was cool, I was like, cool. And then we started a new tempo.
So that's all like visual cues.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah.
Let's speed it up a little bit.
Yeah, speed it up, hike it down, keep it there, whatever it is. So.
By the way, we just saw, when you leaned back, I saw that you have a Trumpet Mafia t-shirt on. So kudos for that. We saw it the other night. Great band. And the other thing that I thought was really the thing that made it feel so fluid was you moving from one instrument to another and things would come and go. And so you would have one layer of something and then all of a sudden you'd be at the bass and putting the whole thing in a different kind of context. And she must be really amazing at hearing that and picking it up and fitting it into the loop along with all the other drum machine sounds she has going on.
Exactly. So it's really like a work in real-time composition in terms of the fluidity, because at any moment there could be a tempo change, there can be a key change. If you notice in certain parts in the set, even during the piece Cyborg Swing, where we superimpose video of Miles Davis and so forth, there's a period where there's a keyboardist, which is me, but I have Herbie on the screen and is going through different keys so she can change the parameters bit by bit and change the keys to create these modulations and resolutions and turnarounds. So sometimes she's doing that and I'm playing and I don't know where she's going to go and I just have to hear it. Like if we're on a gig, let's say it's the Miles Davis Second Great Quintet, sometimes Herbie's playing these alternate things and Ron goes and they don't necessarily know where they're going to go, but they just go for a space and in a direction and wherever they end up is where they end up as long as you land on your feet.
Right, right. There's a lot of trust in that, but it's also, you know, taking all the technology and turning it back into something human and interactive and something that is moving in real time based on what you're feeling and wanting to express, what you're wanting to say in the moment. And that's really, it's hard to do.
Exactly.
You know? And you don't hear that a lot.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people kind of shit on electronics and technology because they feel like it's automated. But to me, ultimately, they're tools. Mm-hmm. And the person controlling those tools decides the parameters. So I feel like we're using these technological mediums in the same way one would use a piano, which is, again, a technological advent. So they're all tools and machines, ultimately. A trumpet doesn't do anything, right? Well, that's a lot of people like, hey, man, that horn sounds great. Well, thanks.
I don't hear anything.
It's not in there, bro.
And also, same point, and, you know, not to be repetitive, but like as a composer, you know, you learn how to write for a saxophone player. And there's certain things and skills and certain challenges and certain nice, sweet areas and other areas that might be more strident. And that's a tool, like you say. So, you know, writing for her, especially in real time, is kind of, well, in some ways it's a future process. In some ways it's a very old process.
Exactly. Ancient to the future.
Yeah.
AACM used to say. Thank you.
So like you, like yourself, Sasha comes from a musical family.
Yeah.
Right? Her father is the guitarist.
Steve Mazakowski, great guitarist, has played in my bands. He was in my first electronic band back in the 90s, Time Machine, when I was working out a lot of these ideas that people heard on albums later, like Sonic Trance and so forth. Brilliant master in his own right. And New Orleans is riddled with these dynasties, these musical families that pass on. Her brother is also a great bassist and so forth. So my brother was a musician, and my mom is also a musician. A lot of people talk about my father because he was more out there and on the road, but my mom is a former operatic singer as well as a classical pianist. And her father, my grandfather, also was a pianist. And as I'm discovering my genealogy, I found that I have a great, great uncle who was a luthier and made string instruments and was a peer of Buddy Bolden and played with him and so forth. So music goes back quite a bit in my family. On both sides.
That is amazing. I knew about your father, but yeah, I didn't know that your mother. So I have to ask you this. Have you always played all the instruments?
Kind of. Yeah. It's funny. One of the first times I met Wayne Shorter, we were in this city in Japan, Hitachi Naka, where they actually make Hitachi electronic stuff. And there was a tsunami that came right when this festival came. But this was like one of the greatest festivals ever. It was like Jimmy Smith, Tito Puente, Herbie was there with his group, Wayne Shorter, Stanley Turrentine, like all these great artists. And as soon as we got there, there was a tsunami warning. So basically, we couldn't play because the festival was shut down, but we couldn't go home either. So we were all stuck in this hotel. And after a couple of days, we were getting a little stir crazy. So a lot of us just was like, fuck it, we'll set up. And we set up in the lobby of the hotel and jammed and started hanging out. So in the midst of this jam, I was playing a lot of the different instruments and so forth. And as I say, Herbie and Wayne was there. So Wayne was checking it out. And when we finished, and as people know, Wayne, he's not a man of a lot of words, but when he says something, it's very impactful. So he just came up to me and he was like, people say Stevie Wonder plays all the instruments, but you play all the instruments. And then he just darted out. I was like, wow, okay. But yeah, you know, playing a lot of the instruments was just something very natural to me. Growing up in a musical family, as I said, we always had a piano around. My dad played bass, that was always around. I got to see some of the world's greatest musicians in my own living room doing rehearsals. People like Ellis Marsalis and Professor Longhair, they all came and sat at our home piano. A lot of my great trumpet mentors like Clyde Kerr Jr., Wendell Brunius, who's still with us playing his ass off, Leroy Jones, still with us playing his ass off. All these guys were just around, and Jermaine Basil, who was like our, she's like the holy grail of vocalists here. And these were just people who were just like my aunts and uncles just around as a kid. But I was watching this level of mastery at a very young age, taking it all in long before I made the decision to be a professional musician. So yeah, it was just natural to me. I mean, even before I played trumpet, which I started trumpet at four. Before that, I started on Suzuki violin for a couple months, and I didn't really like it too much. But as soon as I could crawl up on something, Dave, I was playing it and not thinking that I'm going to be a professional musician years later. But it was just around and a part of the environment, and I took to it.
You were doing what you were seeing. Thank you. thing that you did a few times in the flow of the set where, I mean, I guess you know, you would call Sasha's drum loops straight eighth note time feel. And
sometimes negotiate the straight versus swung, but yeah.
It seemed like, yeah, but there were clear moments where against her straight eighth note, you were playing a swing time feel, starting usually from the bass, but then when you came in on the trumpet, it was like, wow, how is he doing, you know? And it's amazing. It's really grooving. But is that something you spent some time thinking about and sort of developing?
Not in a conscious sense, but I think subconsciously that toying with where one is and the parameters of how many subdivisions make up one. Like, to me, that's one of the hallmarks of Louis Armstrong, who's the father of us all, mm-hmm. where he redefined the quarter note. And to me, that hasn't happened in recorded history, to my knowledge, too many times. The only times I can think of in our recent history is Louis Armstrong and then perhaps Jay Dilla, where somebody redefines where we feel the one. Louis Armstrong, just from very early on, he sort of revolutionized our concept of where you feel one, two, three, four. And one of the great examples of that is his recording of Stardust, where the group is playing this kind of almost corny background of just like pulling back the time, sometimes leaning forth into it, and really toying with the idea of time itself and how it's somewhat of an artificial construct. You know, we all relate to time in terms of time to wake up, time to go to school, time to go to work, time to have lunch, time or whatever. But what is time really? You know, it's like we've been in this lockdown, which seems like it happened yesterday, but you turn around and the year's almost over.
Yeah.
So this whole idea of playing with time, I think, is something that has been instrumental in most of the major innovations of recorded music. Certainly within the popular specter in the 20th century and now into the 21st century, usually the great innovations and the changes and the shifts come from a perspective of where a person feels time.
Yeah.
You know, from Louis Armstrong and to the big band era, from the New Orleans era to the Kansas City era to the bebop era, where that was a certain thing. The Detroit sound, the West Coast laid back thing, all these territories and tributaries of different regions and lineages impact ultimately how the music sounds. And I always say that, you know, our music is often defined not so much by genre, but from a very native and indigenous categorization of territories geographically and lineage. It boils down to like, where are you from and from whom you came through?
Mm.
And that's something I see you expounding upon in terms of, you know, the festival. Like, you'll have different icons, different masters that you tribute, and all of these little tributaries and lines and lineages that come through, sometimes disparate, sometimes how they intersect, like rivers. And I find that geographic location is a big factor in how music sounds. Places with lakes, music sounds a certain way. There's a stillness. Places with rivers sound a certain way. Places that are on the coast have a certain vibration. And if you're on the Pacific coast versus the Atlantic coast versus Mediterranean area, all these geographic locations and elements play a big factor. Places that are in the desert, places that are mountainous, places that are in a valley, all these different things go into it. And that's just the geographic aspect.
Mm.
then you have from whom you came through. You know, are you a product of Louis Armstrong? Or are you a child of Charlie Shavers? Do you come through Billie Holiday or Carmen McRae? You have all these lineages, and then the different people add something and take the baton to another place. You know, it's easy to, you know, you can see where Louis Armstrong sort of sits at this as a primary resource for so many of us in 20th century and post 20th century music. But, you know, Billie Holiday comes out of him. But then you have, you know, out of that, you also have Frank Sinatra coming out of Armstrong. You also have Bing Crosby coming out of Armstrong. And all the people they've impacted, influenced. And Billie Holiday influencing Carmen McRae. You know, you have Coleman Hawkins, and then you have, you know, Bird coming out of that energy. Lester Young coming out of that energy. And all of the people who came forth through them. So, you know, it really gets complex and deep, which is why I feel like when you embark upon this career as an artist, it's important to do your homework and understand from where you come from and the reasons why you choose to embark on this, which is the primary reason why many years ago I started the BAM movement. BAM is an acronym for Black American Music.
And you had the flag in the room that you were recording in.
And it's not to draw a line in the sand and see who can or can't play it based on race. It's just an acknowledgement of the source and the wellspring from which this music comes from. And I feel it's a liberating source for all of us, really, particularly in these times of COVID and Black Lives Matter and so forth, where we're really at a point of reckoning and really at a crossroads of deciding our future as a global society.
Yeah.
And we're really on the side of, are we going to be on the side of indigenous and ancient traditions, or are we going to be on the side of the industrial sort of this, if you will, construct that has kind of been placed upon us that has ultimately served as oppressive. My feeling like is that there's somewhere in the middle. It's not about a right or wrong per se, but there can be a marriage of these ideas to create this conglomerate that doesn't serve at the destruction of everything around us. I don't know if we've reached this point to figure it out, but I think somewhere there has to be the abandonment of everything perhaps that we've been taught to be true, at least to bring into question where it comes from and is this actually our reality? And that's where I kind of think we are as a global society.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
The geographical thing, I hadn't really thought of that. And, you know, when I moved out of the city some years ago, my music changed. And I never really realized why. And now hearing you say that, I'm like, oh, that, you know, that makes a lot of sense. There's actually trees here.
Yeah. it's energy. You know, when we think about it, we're impacted by the energy that's around us. And that affects how we hear and our outlook.
Mm. So just to go back to the piece a little bit, we talked a little bit about the overall flow, and it sounds like, you know, the arc of the whole shape of the thing, that a lot of that is improvised, that you guys are, you know, passing ideas back and forth on the fly. But there's that whole section with Pent Up House where there's multiple trumpets playing and they're bouncing off different key areas and using fragments of the piece and moving them around in a really interesting way. And I just couldn't help but think that, you know, there had to be some preordained.
Oh.
So wait, but was that done in real time using loops?
That was done in real time. Now,
wow.
We edited shit down. Well, one big thing was that whole middle section, you notice, it goes away from the live video of Sasha and I to whatever.
Yeah.
Basically, there was a glitch, and the guy who was recording us kind of lost 20, 30 minutes of video in the middle that I wanted to use.
Ooh.
So I basically had to build that section. That's why you stopped to see us, stop seeing us, and you see James Brown and Clifford and Sonny. Now, the thing is the music was done in real time. It was seamless.
I see.
The video, I did edit and sort of create a visual narrative to what's happening. But how I was hearing and the relationship between Prisoner of Love, actually the beat of the song is from a song we did on the Quarantine with Nick album called Charmin Shortage Blues, which was an homage to not being able to find toilet paper, which I still don't understand. I'm still mad at y'all. Why did y'all go out and buy toilet paper? I'm still mad at y'all for that. Why? I don't understand. But fuck it. I just said, we wrote a tune to it. So the beat is from there. I saw the connection between that. I love that James Brown interview. As musicians, that's like classic to most of us. Like
in America.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, wow, that works over that. And then I'm just thinking in that mode of all the things. Sonny Rollins is one of my biggest influences. He's one of the greatest true spontaneous composers / improvisers ever, in my knowledge. That to me, it's this whole thing of Black American music to me, like how these things are all interconnected. We look at them as different things and classify R&B, so-called jazz, this, that, and the other. But all these themes are connected through what I call African tribal DNA. And I just kind of like to illustrate and play with when you hear something that's like, this sounds like it might as well be spring, and it might as well be spring played by Clifford Brown. Sounds like Pent Up House, and Pent Up House sounds like Bejo, which Earth, Wind & Fire did. Nice. These things are not as unrelated as we tend to make them.
It's coming from someplace deep inside you that's making these connections.
It's like a stream of consciousness thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
This thing makes me think of that, and that thing makes me think of this.
Right.
When we're creating these things, and I think because we have these sections where they're 4 or maybe 8 bar loops, I'm forced to be super creative in finding out ways to variate that so that they sound interesting, so that they sound like 32 bar or longer forms. So I'm trying to figure out a way to variate them in as such that there's some feeling of linear, that there's some linear flow within this short, relatively short circular flow, if that makes any sense.
Said about the trumpet festival, you know, we've been doing it a long time now. I started it with Roy Campbell Jr. and he's no longer with us. But the thing that I've always loved about it is that it's not about any style or any. It's a festival built around the instrument. So it means that anything anybody's doing around creative music involving the trumpet is in that wheelhouse.
Yeah.
Is a part of the trumpet festival, but because it's a trumpet festival and there's probably some trumpet players that are going to watch this conversation, I have to ask you about trumpet playing. And also with my own curiosity. Okay. So like your tone, well, you're able to vary it a lot, but you're able to get that super warm, fat, round sound, and then you're able to sneak some air into it when you want to. Mm-hmm. That gives it this really sort of intimate, warm, I don't want to use too many adjectives, but I guess what I would have to ask is like, I mean, you've been playing a long time, so I know, you know, our needs as musicians change over the years. Mm-hmm. Things, you know, the demands change and your thinking changes and what you hear changes. But do you have anything that you would say to some young trumpet players in terms of being able to develop that facility, the fluidity and the tone?
Good question. And it's something I definitely grappled with, particularly early on when I was saying about these different variants of sound. I remember like when I first heard like Freddie Hubbard, who I eventually learned was a offshoot of Clifford Brown, who then I learned was an offshoot of Fats Navarro. And again, we're dealing with these lineages, Lee Morgan, that there was this airiness sometimes that they would get in the sound. And I would ask people, how do I get that air in my sound? And no one could answer it for me. And I kind of felt they were being jived, like there was some secret. They didn't want to tell me. And what I realized is that—
They didn't tell me either.
There is no secret.
That's why I'm asking you.
Yeah. There is no secret. The closest I've come to was one of my great teachers, my trumpet guru Clyde Kerr Jr. He said you got to think of warm air, it's cool air. And it's almost, when he said it was like, okay, like that kind of sound through the horn versus a So, but I had discovered it 10 years before that. It was like, where were you when I was trying to figure that shit out? But yeah, sound to me is an issue of primarily what you hear. If you really hear it, I think the body knows how to produce it. So the question is not what physical manipulations you can do to create the sound, more so than truly hearing what it is you want to produce and trusting and letting the body do what it does to create it. Because when you think about what we do, all the years you've been playing, do you know exactly how tight your lips need to be formed to create a high C? I don't fucking know. Like,
depends on the day.
Yeah. But to me, if you hear it in your head, like you really sting that C or G, it comes out of the trumpet. Because the lips know what to do. The tongue knows exactly how much to arch. Mm-hmm. If you relax into it and truly hear it, it's coming out of the horn. What we do when we practice is we discipline our bodies, our temples, our larger instruments outside of the trumpets, if you will, to condition it to be able to know where all these slots are. Mm. Right? So through repetition, we've played, I don't know how many thousands of high Cs in our practice. Mm-hmm. So our lips know exactly how tight, how much they have to vibrate, how much air has to go through, whatever. That's what practice is for. Mm-hmm. To me, the worst thing you could do on a gig is worry about that shit while you're trying to play. That's why you practice, to me, to earn the right in the field of play, not have to think about it. So to me, this is what's very important, earning the right to be in that space to let go. And you can't supplant that with something else. Some people just want to immediately go there and hide behind, well, I just want to express myself. Yeah, that's all beautiful. But there has to be, to me, a discipline in place to ultimately earn the right to be in that space to be free. That freedom is a result of form. There's no freedom without form. There's no form without freedom. So it's a confluence of elements and a dichotomy by which we're negotiating in real time, even as we play live, of these elements and the things we've worked on and how much trust not only that we have in the other musicians we're working with, but in ourselves. How much confidence do I feel within myself when I go to sting that high G that is going to come out? If I waver in my mind and I let go of that G in my mind and I doubt it, it's probably going to crack because I didn't truly believe in it. If I let it go and I know it's fucking coming out and I go for it, there's a great chance I'll nail it, minimally. And when I'm really there, sometimes I'll overshoot it. Sometimes maybe I'll hit that double C. Oh, shit, I didn't know. So to me, when we practice as brass players, the thing for me is almost like weight training. We want to overtrain. I overtrain in my practice. I play much higher in my practice routines than I expect or necessarily have the desire to play in my live situations. So, for instance, well, I work on Clark, and in the book, it takes it up to high C. But oftentimes, I'll take my shit to the G. So, you know, or I work on Chickamauga's flow studies, which typically go from a high C, high D maybe. I take mine all the way up to the double C. But if I get used to playing the double C in my practice routine, it's nothing for me to be consistent on a high G. So overtrain on our instrument to be able to overperform of our expectations, even if we have an off night where we're below those expectations and I'm not hitting a double G, I'm stinging a high G, it's pretty fucking good. Not a night, you know?
Thank you.
you so much. Thanks for creating the piece. And join, you know, Festival of New Trumpet Music. I think it's our 18th season, and I can't believe this is the first time you've done it. And part of that is because we're all locked down, and so we're all working remotely. So we were able to call you and have you create this piece this way. And I think it's really great. Like you said, it will live in the archive, and I'm sure you'll have it on your channels. Mm-hmm. And it's a fantastic, beautiful, moving piece of work, and I couldn't be happier to have this be the final night of what's been 10 amazing nights of music and community, and people all around the world doing this, whatever this crazy irrational instrument it is that we're trying to bring beauty out of. You know, that's what it is. This is such a odd time right now. You mentioned it before, you know, all the many multiple crises going on that we're all dealing with. And yeah, like yourself, I'm fortunate I've got a place to work and my family's okay. But it's easy to get dark on it. Yeah. And so I've been asking people that I meet, you know, what is something that makes you hopeful? What is something that you see might be something good that's happening?
To me, this stuff that's going on is the shit of life. You know, life is a series of troubles and triumphs. Mm. And we're ultimately defined by our ability or lack thereof to overcome them, or how that shapes us going through whatever trajectory. To me, it's we're just gone in hyper mode right now. But is it really significantly different? No. I mean, when I look at my personal life, like, I was trying to tell people of the importance of acknowledging Black culture and Black American music 10 years ago. For us to get in a space where we're really ready now to actually have that conversation. To me, it's really an affirmation in soldiering for your vision and not being afraid to stand alone despite everything sometimes feeling like it's conspiring against you to tell you otherwise. And when I look at the artists who I love and who mean the world to me and who we all celebrate, these are all people who did that. It's Billie Holiday doing that despite the world telling her as a Black woman she can't create a vision of what that meant before her. Like, when we look at her, that didn't exist. The idea of a Black American woman did not exist before her. And as a result of her, we even have someone like Amy Winehouse, who's from a different coast, a different race, a whole different thing, but it just sort of ties us all in. And really, what the lesson is that we're called forth through these difficult times, as unfortunate as it may be on a certain level, to have the space, the stillness, to analyze and to address who we are and what we want to do. Wow. And I think even the fact that we're having these heavy political and racial conversations, you know, if we really want to look at it honestly, Black people were getting killed on Obama's watch. Black Lives Matter started under Obama with Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. So Black people have been getting killed by police for the inception of this country. Yeah. I think what has made the difference is the stillness that the lockdown of COVID allowed us to look at it through a different lens. We can look at it as a bad thing, or we can look at it as a blessing, that we've arrived at a certain level of awareness not afforded to us beforehand in the normalcy of our daily lives. I perhaps choose to look at it as a blessing as hurtful and deeply painful as it is, many of those we've lost as a result of all this, maybe that we didn't have to lose due to the ineptitude of certain people who are supposed to be responsible for caring for us. But regardless of that, this is the space we're in right now, and we're called to bring forth who are we in this moment and what are we going to do about it. And really, that's no different than any other time in society. That is always the question. Who are you and what choices will you make?
Thank you so much, Nicholas.
Thanks, Dave.
Great talking to you. Hope we get to do it more often and possibly even in person. Thanks for the piece. Really appreciate it. Wonderful. So you take care. Stay safe.
You too, bro.
All right.
Enjoyed the music. Thanks for listening. Come check out Greenleaf Music and say hello. Thanks.